good horse, I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of
I started what I have come to call a spiritual growing up or a psychological growing up. It takes you from the self-centered life or the life governed by the self-centered nature into the life governed by the nature which is centered in the good of the whole, which sees you as a part of the whole and works for the good of the whole, which sees that you're a cell in the body of humanity, that every cell, every human being has, well, equal importance, equal potential, although in varied stages of growth, because we choose how much growing we do, and a job to do in the total scheme of things. That was my preparation for the pilgrimage.
You're listening to episode 609 of Unwelcome Guests, Flight from Meaning, Part 4. I'm Robin Upton, and the words you heard were spoken by Peace Pilgrim, a remarkable American woman whose retirement project was to walk back and forth across America promoting the message of peace. I first discovered her a few years ago while researching people who lived without money. She lived for over a quarter of a century without using money, without asking anyone for food or a place to stay, accepting only what was freely given. A dramatic demonstration of people's natural goodness and desire to help others, which Alfie Cohn alluded to a couple of weeks ago. Well, we'll be devoting our second hour to her. We're going to start this week's show looking at madness. We have an interview with Ethan Miller speaking about culturally defined notions of acceptable or unacceptable behavior, the fact that madness is a very different thing from organic diseases, which present in similar fashions around the world. And whilst drug companies would love us to think otherwise, this is something that is socially defined, something that has a meaning. I'm reminded of Ivan Illich's quote that to demand our children feel well in the world which we leave them is an insult to their dignity. Now, according to the WHO, depression is set to be the biggest health burden on society, both economically and sociologically, within 20 years. Now, this warning was given in the run-up to the first Global Mental Health Summit in Athens in 2009. Now, the WHO was bemoaning the fact that developing countries spent less than 2% of their national budgets on mental health care. I wonder what they'd make of Ethan Miller's thoughts. Now, I'm going out on a limb here, but I suspect if you're a regular Unwelcome Guests listener, you are more likely than most to be found mentally unhealthy, just because knowing what you must know about the society in which you live, I think you couldn't help but behave in strange ways, in ways which are not the norm. Does that mean that you're sick? Does that mean that you're in need of treatment? Well, if we believe that man is a machine and deviant behavior should be avoided, well then yeah, and there's drug companies lining up to fill you with pills to try and assist in the normalization of your behavior. We're going to find time to hear a few remarks from Steve Talbot about problems of the man as machine model. Now let's hear an interview from earlier this year, courtesy of Madness Radio.
Ethan, you've written a really interesting book about the way in which the United States and the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual is kind of being exported as a product around the world and then reshaping how mental illnesses, mental health diagnoses are received in different cultures. And maybe we should get started just by asking, well, isn't psychiatry, isn't mental illness really a medical issue? Why is it that you've discovered a lot of diversity around the world? Why is it that you see this international difference taking place?
Yes, I think every generation of psychiatrists would like to make the case that they have moved beyond culture, that they are now seeing these disorders as they're in their solid state form and their universal form. But even the briefest look across history shows us that culture shapes the expression of mental illnesses. That is, the expectations of the people around you, the healers, the family members, one's own expectations about how the mind works and how, you know, what disorders are salient, deeply influences the expression of these diseases. So you look back, say, in Victorian era England, and you see tens of thousands of women experiencing hysterical leg paralysis or hysterical blindness, for instance. That illness rose and became very popular during a period and then simply went away. The same is true of Ian Hacking's The Mad Travelers, where young men would travel in fugue states across Europe with no sense of their identity and no sense of who they were. Another example of an illness that sort of becomes salient in one moment in history and then disappears in another moment in history. And the thesis of this book is that that's not gone away, that every generation has an idea about the human psyche, an idea about mental illness, and those ideas deeply influence the unconscious minds of people that suffer from these conditions. So that's the number one premise of the book. And then the second premise of the book is that because America is so good at shipping our ideas across borders, we categorize these illnesses, we make the drug treatments for these illnesses, we convince the rest of the world to think like us in this way. So if you put those two ideas together, you have this sort of uncomfortable premise that indeed, as we export our ideas around the world, we may not only be changing the way people categorize and treat these illnesses, but we may be changing these illnesses themselves. We may be actually homogenizing the way the world experiences mental illness.
Now, you've got a number of really detailed examples from around the world that illustrate the themes you're discussing, but let me just start by asking something that comes up a lot on Madness Radio, is the question of whether we can really conceive these as diseases and illnesses if they are so shaped by culture, society, and they do end up turning out to be very, very different in the cultural, political, and economic context that they're in. Because a disease, we think of a disease like tuberculosis or cancer, I mean, it pretty much is something that appears different cultures pretty much physically the same way. You can look at it under a microscope, you can do certain kinds of blood tests, but with what we're calling mental illness or disorders or mental disease, it's really kind of a different experience. What's your view about that?
I think we're never going to understand these conditions unless we understand them as a combination of genetics, biology, social psychology, and our cultural understanding of these things. So in the American mind, though, it's oftentimes when you say something is, for instance, psychosomatic, what people will hear you saying is that people are faking their illness. And my case is that something like PTSD is indeed different over different, soldiers in different wars have experienced different types of PTSD because they have different cultural beliefs about the mind. So a soldier in the Civil War would have come home with DaCosta's syndrome, which is a pain in the chest and a sort of severe homesickness, you know. And a soldier in First World War would have had shell shock, which symptoms would have been largely physiological, sort of motor tics and paralysis and that sort of thing. But that doesn't mean that those soldiers were faking those symptoms. They were simply, their unconscious mind was responding to the beliefs about the mind that were salient at the time. So I'm making this very hard to understand case, especially hard for Americans to understand, that this, the idea is that things like PTSD and things like depression and things like hysteria are true for given times and places, but not true for all times and places. I'm not saying these illnesses are false or are not deeply felt, but they are indeed combinations of cultures. And so I do think the premise of your question is that I would agree they exist in a different category than, you know, biological infections and things like cancer. I don't think it's a parallel, because a cancer, by and large, doesn't care what you think about it. A mental illness like depression or like PTSD, does indeed matter how you think about it, and more specifically, how the people around you think about it and categorize it.
And I think also there's a whole question of the way in which the categories themselves, the DSM, the criteria for what gets called a disorder and what doesn't get called a disorder, is very political, and we've talked a lot about that on Madness Radio, the shifting diagnostic categories themselves. But let's get into the examples that you have from the book, because you've written a really amazing investigative work on how this actually takes place in different cultures. And one of the first things that you talk about in the book is eating disorders and anorexia in Hong Kong. Now, tell us about what you learned about that.
Right, so I profiled a psychiatrist there named Sing Lee, and he was very interested in the 1980s to try to find out whether anorexia existed in Hong Kong, because it just wasn't in the medical literature there. So he went back and looked at decades of hospital records to try to see if he could find this illness in the Hong Kong population. And indeed, he did find a few examples of it. It was a very rare disorder. And it also didn't have some of the aspects of it that is very common in America. It didn't have body dysmorphia, and it didn't have fat phobia, and it didn't seem to be connected to diet crazes or the desire to lose weight. So he was in the midst of documenting this very specific form of Chinese self-starvation at a moment in time when the ground sort of suddenly shifted underneath him. Suddenly, in the mid-90s, you had this rise of the American form of anorexia. And I traced that cultural shift, the death of one young woman on a downtown Hong Kong street who collapsed and died on her way home from school, who's clearly an anorexic. But at that moment, the press in Hong Kong, because this woman had died in such a public way, had to sort of tell the population what this illness was. What did this woman die? What caused her illness? What are the symptoms that come with this? And at that point, basically, the Hong Kong media turned to the West, because we are known to be, experts in this area, in the general area of psychiatry, but also specifically with eating disorders. And they basically imported this idea of anorexia and said, it's young women, it has these other symptoms. And it was only after that young woman died in 1994 that you saw a rise of the American form of the illness. So the case I'm making in the book is that anorexia can go along cultural currents. I think most people would believe that, and they would think of cultural currents like eating, diet trends, exercise trends, fashion trends, and so forth. But the case I make in the book is that it also can go along other cultural currents, and one of those cultural currents is indeed our public discourse about the illness itself, that things like anorexia are pretty clearly, they can be like social contagion. And you have to remember, this was a very nervous time in Hong Kong's history. This was after, Tiananmen Square on the mainland and before the changeover to Hong Kong rule. And it was a time of quickly changing roles for women. There was lots of immigration. It was a very stressful time for this population. But as one of my favorite scholars pointed out, there is no one way for a population in that time in history to express that form of distress. This is when the unconscious mind goes to cross-cultural psychiatrists, they look towards the symptom pool of their time. And again, this is the idea that certain symptoms will be accepted as legitimate in certain times and places, and others will not, and your unconscious mind will be drawn towards the symptoms that effectively communicate your distress. And at one point in Hong Kong history, anorexia was not in that symptom pool. And then, a decade later, it was in that symptom pool, and it drew more and more women to that behavior.
So you're not saying that there were all of these anorexics, women who were starving themselves, who were extremely suffering from not eating and negative body image, all the things that we associate with anorexia in the United States. You're not saying that there were all these women in Hong Kong who were there, but just weren't discovered. You're actually saying that the actual phenomenon itself came as a result of the Hong Kong media educating people in Hong Kong to expect and have a preconception and to start to think of themselves in a new way. And that's where the export of culture dynamic comes in. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So that you have the discourse about, I'm basically making the case of the prime creators of that symptom pool. For instance, that symptom pool, that's the idea that certain symptoms are legitimate and certain symptoms are not. The prime creators of that symptom pool are the healers in a given time period. So it is the healers that declare this is a legitimate symptom and this is not, and it's oftentimes, and this is what you saw with hysteria as well, and that's when the unconscious mind responds to those cultural expectations. And the point is that this is happening on an unconscious level. This is the unconscious mind looking to the culture that they're in to understand what is the language of suffering for my moment in history. And, given moment in history, you'll your unconscious mind will look to culture and it will find hysterical leg paralysis. And another time it'll find stomach pain. And another time it'll find anorexia. What I don't think we've fully understood yet is that cultural connection, but also the fact that the healers in our any given time are largely behind the creation of that symptom pool. That's not to say that they're behind the psychopathology that causes people to look to that symptom pool, but they are behind the symptom pool, and they oftentimes, and now I think we know that that symptom pool can drift across cultural borders, especially when you have the sort of social psychiatric influence that America does around the world.
So you're saying that Hong Kong's culture and society becomes more like the United States, that there's a homogenization process that happens, and the way in which that is transmitted is through the healers, the professionals, the doctors, the medical establishment adopting an American Western view of this is a disease, this is a disorder, we're going to call this anorexia the way that the people in the United States do, and then the people in the society actually respond to that, and then you start to have the appearance of anorexia, people with anorexia in Hong Kong, where you didn't actually have that before.
That's exactly right. So this is not a case of them of Hong Kong simply not recognizing that they had anorexics among them. And in fact, anorexia is a very difficult disease not to see when it's there because the symptoms and consequences are so remarkable.
And I think with examples from other disorders that we're going to be speaking about, it's even more pronounced. But of course, the consequence of that is that suddenly you have a market created where you didn't actually have a market for U.S.-based pharmaceutical interventions, medical interventions. And so a lot of this is really a political economic process.
That's exactly right. And that is the case that I make in the last chapter of the book, which has to do with Japan and the homogenization of the idea of depression and how where we draw the line between sadness that is normal and sadness that is pathological. And indeed, one of the primary vectors of this spread around the world is the tremendous amount of resources that drug companies put behind the promotion of the American sort of standard of where to draw these lines. And Japan was this fantastic example of GlaxoSmithKline and other drug companies going in there and really intentionally trying to influence culture on this level.
So previously in Japan, you didn't have a concept of depression.
So you did have a concept of depression, but it was thought of in this way. It's often translated as endogenous depression, and it was considered a severe and rare form of mental illness. So that is, if you had this sort of form of endogenous depression, you would be considered severely mentally ill in all likelihood in a psychiatric hospital. It was rare as well. So and of course, Japan has the full spectrum of sadness of any culture. But anthropologists have pointed out that Japan has a cultural embrace of sadness. That is, it's written into the songs, it's written into the music, it's part of the religion. That there's a belief about sadness that it can be a place where you find moral guidance. This is not an emotional state to be afraid of. It's not an emotional state to instantly run away from or try to cover up, as we often do in the West.
It reminds me of the history of depression in the United States, where there was, in Europe, there was this idea of melancholy prior to depression, and it was seen with greater esteem. It was seen as a source of poetic inspiration, of a certain kind of a noble experience. And then something happened in Japan where that different view of sadness was changed into the pathology, the disease of depression, which is then a market for antidepressants. How did that process take place? What is it that GlaxoSmithKline, the huge pharmaceutical company that sells antidepressants, what did they do to actually make that change happen in Japan?
Well, the most fascinating thing that I think they did, I talked to a cross-cultural psychiatrist named Lawrence Kermayer up in McGill, and he told me this fantastic story about GlaxoSmithKline actually co-opting the very profession of cross-cultural psychiatry. And cross-cultural psychiatry is filled with these remarkable scholars who know a great deal about how cultures differ in these ways. And in many ways, they really value and prize those differences, like a biologist would value and prize differences of plant species. And GlaxoSmithKline went in and actually threw a lot of money at these cross-cultural psychiatrists because they wanted to know what they knew. And what they knew was about how cultures shape the experience of mental illness. And for a time, even Lawrence Kermayer, who's really one of the stars in this field, was a little bit romanced by the amount of money and amount of attention GlaxoSmithKline was lavishing on him at these incredibly luxurious conferences and these travels. Because he was co-opted momentarily by that group, you did get this fantastic inside story about watching these GlaxoSmithKline scholars. These weren't just the marketing men. These were people that knew a great deal about culture and mental illness. He got to watch firsthand how GlaxoSmithKline was intentionally going in and thinking about how do we move the line in Japan? So you have this, you know, full spectrum of sadness, but we want to move the line between where the normal and the pathological was, because as we said before, the line for where the normal and the pathological was way over on one side. It only thought of it really severe forms of sadness as pathological, and everything else was considered to varying degrees culturally normal. They learned from these cross-cultural psychiatrists, you know, about how Japan had shaped its experiences over time, and they began to co-opt the Japanese psychiatrists into the camp to suggest that actually the American form of depression, where you have sort of a few weeks of sadness as being indicators of a pathology. Again, you know, you often find these changes in societies happening at moments of stress on the society. So this was the 1990s, which was a very bad time economically for Japan. There was been the Kobe earthquake. There was this general sense that America was doing something right in the way it thought about the human mind. So the culture itself was actually fairly receptive to it. And so GlaxoSmithKline spent, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars sponsoring conferences, co-opting Japanese psychiatrists, advertising, creating what appeared to be grassroots depression support groups, all in the attempt to sell Paxil, which they had spent a great deal of money getting through the approval process in Japan. And it would not be enough simply for them to corner the market on the few cases of endogenous depression. They intended, GlaxoSmithKline spent hundreds of millions of dollars both co-opting local Japanese psychiatrists, spending a great deal on advertising, creating these sort of web-based groups that appeared to be grassroots depression support groups. They sponsored conferences. They threw a tremendous amount of money with the idea of not only marketing a pill, Paxil, but marketing the American form of depression. And indeed, you know, the rise of people that now classify themselves as depressed or have a prescription for Paxil in Japan has just been remarkable. This is a $1 billion business now, whereas before it was considered a very rare disorder in Japan.
So the manufacturers of Paxil, the antidepressant, GlaxoSmithKline, go into Japan. They see that there are all these people who are maybe sad, but they aren't really considered to have depression. They aren't considered to be diseased or disordered, and they certainly don't need psychiatric treatment. And then they actually created a whole market by redefining that experience culturally. And you said that the market now for Paxil in Japan is more than $1 billion?
Over the last 10 years, it's definitely been more than $1 billion. The sort of yearly totals change, but there was not a market there before for antidepressants. And to make a market there, they not only had to convince the culture that they should take this pill, but they had to convince the culture that more people have this disease than they considered before.
What would you say to someone who says, well, look, okay, maybe Japan didn't have a definition of depression, they didn't have that view of it as a disorder, but all those people who were sad, who are now taking Paxil, those were really people who were kind of discovered as depressed, and they really did need something that they didn't have.
Well, again, I think you have to look at the broader cultural story. So were people that were sad, were they finding solace in the rich literature and stories that Japan devoted to the state of sadness and poetry? And were they finding solace in the religions, which were, you know, had a great deal of tolerance for sadness? But I think the argument that you just mentioned is not without its validity. And for instance, you know, there has been a decline of the suicide rate in Japan, which is quite high in the 90s, since the introduction of antidepressants to the culture. So I think it's not necessarily always the case that our technology is wrong or bad, or that you know, these interventions have only negative outcomes. I don't think that's true. I think it is more true to say that we are not considering all the outcomes and considering how deeply we are affecting and changing cultures when we import our Western ideas about the mind and mental illness. And I think my book hopes not to sort of make only the case that these interventions are negative, but that other people have deeply sophisticated and long-held beliefs about the human mind that are tied to their culture, that are tied to their expressions of these illnesses, and we need to have a greater respect for them and understand how they work and what they mean in these cultures before we go blasting in there with multi-million-dollar ad campaigns promoting the American way of thinking about sadness.
Well, I think the question of antidepressants and suicide, that's a very complicated question. We could sort of get into that because there could be a lot of different reasons why the suicide rate has gone down. And there certainly are a lot of research suggesting that antidepressants can contribute to suicide because there have been some warnings from the FDA about that, for example. So,
and the Japanese have put a black label warning on Paxil in regards to its use for adolescents. So they are seem to be, at least on a regulatory level, very convinced by some aspects of that research. I do think I would agree with sort of what I think David Healy's conclusions that oftentimes antidepressants increase suicidality or the potential for suicidality in one population, where it might decrease it in another, and you're sort of trading off risk when you put these drugs in place. And I think that the question about antidepressants and suicidality, especially in those first weeks of use, is a great scandal. And I think what's being discovered by the Senate hearings run by Charles Grassley and so forth has been a tremendous black mark on the pharmaceutical industry.
Well, it also raises the question of if the conception of sadness has been replaced by the idea of depression by this marketing influence, then perhaps the whole cultural understanding of what suicide is and how it relates to everything has been changed as well. And it's a huge area that opens up for investigation and understanding, because what you're saying is that something really important and unique and deeply poetic and literary and philosophical and religious about Japanese culture has, in a sense, started to be lost by this marketing effort from U.S. pharmaceutical companies that are basically about increasing sales of their products by having a very, very deep impact on changing how the culture understands itself historically around something as basic a human experience as sadness.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, these ideas go very deep within cultures, and once we've won the conceptual marketing battle, you can lose notions of the mind and beliefs about the human mind, beliefs about things like sadness and suicide. They can become extinct to that culture. I think sort of conceived of these cross-cultural psychiatrists that I've interviewed and talked to as akin to those biologists in the rainforest, where they are excitedly and hurriedly documenting the changes, the differences they see around the globe, while those differences are quite literally disappearing in front of their eyes.
Now, the question of what we do to treat sadness or how we respond as a culture to something like sadness is very different than something like trauma. And one of the things that you talk about in your book is the tsunami and how that affected Sri Lanka. And many, many Westerners, part of development efforts, part of aid efforts, went to Sri Lanka to help people in this incredibly catastrophic moment where an entire culture, an entire society was traumatized. But you're saying that actually the dynamic is very similar to what we saw happen in Hong Kong and Japan in your explanation. Tell us about the experience in Sri Lanka with trauma and the tsunami.
Absolutely. Well, this is a case where I think we're going into another culture. We're not going in there with a profit motive. Oftentimes the trauma counselors that volunteer to go into other cultures at moments of great distress are doing this on their own dime. They're legitimately trying to help out other populations. But the problem is that even our idea of PTSD, our idea of post-traumatic stress disorder, and the checklist that we have and of the symptoms does not account for all the symptoms around the world. And, you know, as one anthropologist said to me, he said, meaning matters when it comes to psychological trauma. Our initial response to it, the fight or flight response, the adrenaline, the fear, the sense of the unthinkable happening may indeed be fundamentally universal, but the very moment after the trauma, when we begin to assess what has happened to us, begin to look for how do I understand this trauma and how do I express the distress that I feel from it, that instant onward is shaped by culture. It matters a great deal whether you think of the mind as we do in the West, for instance, as the egocentric mind that exists sort of separate from other people, or if you think of the mind, as they do often in Sri Lanka and other places, as a sociocentric mind, which is my sense of self is intimately tied to my place in the group. It matters. Those two conceptions matters when it comes to the consequences of trauma. And someone in Sri Lanka, for instance, would likely see the consequences of the trauma not as existing in their minds the way we think of PTSD, but existing in the trauma and the damage done to the social group and their ability to fulfill their role in that social group. when a Western counselor rushes into a disaster zone like Sri Lanka with no knowledge of that different conception of the mind, with no knowledge of the language or the rituals for grieving or healing, with no knowledge of the, you know, the long history of civil war there, that they'll often simply miss these distinctions. They won't see them. So the deeper knowledge of this that I wrote about in the book, I think, comes from anthropologists who spend a great deal of time talking to Sri Lankans without that PTSD checklist about what was the meaning of this event. If, for instance, as I suggested, that a Sri Lankan would see the damage done to them as done to their role in the social group or to their social group as well, it makes no sense for them to seek healing in a private, you know, let me go away from my social responsibilities and heal with a private one-on-one counselor, for instance. And that's very common in the West, where a soldier coming home, they might be troubled by their battlefield trauma. They think of the PTSD existing as a sickness in their mind, and they say, well, I'm going to need to take time away from my responsibilities to do this healing. That makes sense to us, and that's neither wrong nor right, but it just conforms to our beliefs about PTSD. For a Sri Lankan, to take time away from their social group makes no sense at all, because it is in their place in that social group that they are finding their deepest sense of themselves. So to suggest that to take time away from that is actually to suggest the very symptom that's most troubling to them.
If you're just tuning in, this is Madness Radio, and our guest today is Ethan Waters, the author of Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. So what would be the way to help someone? How can someone who's been traumatized by the tsunami in Sri Lanka actually get the help that they need if it's not sitting down with a Western-style counselor and having this individualistic response?
The best way to think about it is, I think we should help other cultures in distress. And I think what we should assume when we go in there is that other cultures do indeed know that bad events have psychological consequences and not treat PTSD as if we're telling them about a newly discovered disease. They undoubtedly know that the trauma has psychological consequences. And the culture undoubtedly has modes of healing. And those modes of healing may be hidden within religious beliefs, they may be hidden within family structures, they may be hidden within the culture's own conception of the human mind and how the human mind goes through the world. So what we do to help that other culture is not sort of say, here's a bunch of trauma counselors, try it our way, and here's this checklist, but rather to help rebuild the local cultures, do whatever we can in terms of rebuilding the church and rebuilding the schools and getting people housing. And we can assume that within those societies, that there are indeed ways of healing and understanding and dealing with trauma that we may not understand, but they are there, and it's our responsibility to help the society get up and running such that they can do their own healing.
So the society may have its own way of dealing with trauma, but it won't necessarily look like a medical, psychological therapy response. It could be in rituals, it could be in family structures, it could be in the religious practices that the culture has, or just as simple as getting the society back on its feet in terms of agriculture and jobs and housing, and the kind of seeing the problem less from a medical perspective and more from a community development perspective. And it reminds me of an interview that we did with a psychiatrist from Ireland, Pat Bracken, who I spoke with on Madness Radio, who's done a lot of work in Uganda. And he was saying is essentially the same thing that you're saying, that this individualistic idea of a person has a diagnosis and then we provide them with treatment individually just doesn't work in a different context, that it's a community response that's really needed.
It not only doesn't work, but it can actively sort of work against the cultural understandings. And indeed, you can step on metaphorical landmines in this situation, too. And I had one anthropologist who'd done a great deal of study about Western counseling in Sri Lankan villages before the tsunami. And she suggested the very troubling idea that within these small villages, there was often sort of socially prescribed ways of talking about past violence to avoid the flare-up of cycles of revenge violence. Because oftentimes in these little towns, you had the family of the murdered victim living next door to the family of the murderer. And we had families that had a great deal of reasons to hate each other. And there was this pressure to talk only euphemistically about past violence. And into that very delicate balance came Western trauma counselors with this idea that the real way to heal was to do this truth-telling thing where you talked about the violence and you almost sort of emotionally relived it. And that's a Western idea. It makes sense here, but it does not make sense in those villages. And her worry indeed was that this had the real potential to spark cycles of revenge violence.
And I think it's part of a larger discussion about the role of aid and development assistance and charities going into other cultures and having a conception of what helps, but then actually causing a tremendous amount of damage potentially.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think we've learned that there's blowback to these things that we haven't, that we need to fully think about. And I think enlisting the anthropologists in this process and the people that truly know and thought a great deal about how to go into other cultures and be culturally sensitive is very important. I mean, anthropologists sort of just shake their head at the hubris oftentimes. I mean, one anthropologist asked me to imagine the scenario reversed. Imagine that after 9/11 or Katrina, that the healers come from, you know, Mozambique to knock on the doors of the family victims of the deceased and say, you know, we need to help you through these rituals to sever your relationship from the dead. I mean, would that make sense to us? I mean, of course it wouldn't, and we seem to have no problem doing the reverse, and I think we do that because we think that things like PTSD are culturally neutral and universal, and it just takes, you know, not very long at all to realize that they are not.
Ethan, one of the things that we talk a lot about on Madness Radio is the idea of schizophrenia, that schizophrenia is seen as a disease, it's a brain disorder, it's genetic, it is universal, it's something that we discover out in nature, and then actually schizophrenia is much, much more complicated, and it has a very different experience in different cultures. Tell us about the research that you did in Tanzania about how schizophrenia is experienced there in a very different way.
I followed an anthropologist down to Zanzibar who was trying to figure out this very interesting question that exists in the literature, and it's a very famous, perhaps the most famous cross-cultural result, and it was a World Health Organization study that was done over several decades, and it appeared to show that schizophrenics in different cultures, people with schizophrenia in different cultures, had remarkably different outcomes, and in general, people in developing countries did much better than people in the first world. And it's a result that people have just thought about and theorized about a great deal. Robert Whitaker thinks that it has a lot to do with the fact that people in the developed world are more likely to get the drugs, which over time do them more harm than good. I was looking at this from a cultural perspective, and I followed an anthropologist down to Zanzibar who was doing what great anthropologists do, which is sit with families and try to understand what language they're using to talk about this illness. How are they conceiving of this? How are they interacting with their ill individual? And this anthropologist, Julie Magruder, found was that ideas of spirit possession, which often accompany the illness down in Zanzibar, were often used in a way that kept the ill individual within the group. That is, it was not a stigmatizing notion,
It was a normalizing notion, actually said, hey, this is something that happens, it's part of our culture, spirit possession is something that people go through, so you're one of us, you're going to stay with the family, stay with the social group, we're not going to put you away in an institution or a group home or something separate from the rest of the society.
Exactly. We're not going to view you as separate. And I do think that's sort of a critical distinction when you talk about illness narratives across the board. Which of these ideas tend to keep the ill individual within the group, and which of these ideas tend to kick them out? And unfortunately, we've thought in the West about that biological notion of mental illness, the illness like any other, the biogenetic sort of paradigm of mental illness. We've thought of that as a notion that will decrease stigma, that people will see this just like you have diabetes or something like that. And what the social psychologists and psychologists that have studied this around the world have found, it's really remarkable, which is that people who adopt the genetic biological narrative about mental illness tend also to be the ones that want less to do with the people that are diagnosed with mental illnesses, tend to think of them as more permanently broken and more dangerous than they do when they employ a different type of narrative, such as this behavior is caused by something like childhood, for instance.
So it ends up actually increasing discrimination, increasing stigma.
Exactly. We just assumed that it would do the opposite, but the studies around the world show that as we have won this rhetorical battle about mental illness, that we've been losing the war against stigma. So there are still places, such as in Zanzibar, where other narratives are employed to explain this behavior. What Julie Magruder ended up concluding was that the use of that spirit possession notion, that narrative that kept the ill individual within the group, that explained their behavior, actually lowered levels of what psychiatrists call expressed emotion, which is the intensity of emotion that surrounds the illness within the family group. So family members with high expressed emotion were people that were critical or overly involved in the cognitions of the person that they considered ill. And what we've found in general, and this is true across cultures, is that families with high levels of expressed emotion about the ill individual also have ill family members that have a greater relapse rate and who do worse over time.
So the common thread here is the idea that if you normalize the experience, if you say this is part of something that that is human, that we go through this. It's not something that we have to make outside or separate or be afraid of, that the person is going to get better faster and have much better outcomes. And in a different cultural context, like Tanzania, normalizing it would, for that context, be this is spirit possession. This is something that fits into our spiritual religious view of the world, and that's what you're going through.
In that culture, it allows for almost an acceptance of the behavior. And that's a weird, for an American, when you have a family member have a psychotic break or descend into some sort of distressful mental state, we just have this idea, and it's a very American notion of it. Like, we want to fix it. We want to get in there and treat it and fix it and figure it out. And in places like Zanzibar, where you employ the spirit possession belief, there is less of that. And I think what the literature very effectively shows is the more you can sort of tolerate and accept the behavior, the more likelihood that the ill individual will eventually do better over time. But it's certainly not in our American character to do that, to say, like, you know, we're going to accept this behavior. We want people to straighten up and fly right.
Yes, and that's exactly why there's such a push for this idea of mental diversity, or seeing things as part of a range of human experience. One of the cornerstones of the Hearing Voices movement, for example, has been to really emphasize that, look, hearing voices is basically normal. It's part of, it may be somewhat statistically rare, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be separated from humanity. And many people hear voices. And so rethinking these experiences along a spectrum of diversity, this is a continuum of possibilities that doesn't say that we have to exclude people, but actually we can expand our understanding of what's normal and thereby accept and make more acceptable the what it is that someone's going through, is going to lead them to a much better opportunity for recovering, getting better, not being stigmatized or discriminated against, but remaining part of the society and then being able to come back. And before I kind of bring it back to the U.S., I want to just ask you again about Zanzibar and Tanzania. Does the actual what we're calling schizophrenia look like? I imagine it's very different in that context, that actually the symptoms or the signs of schizophrenia are different. Is that right?
I think that's true. I mean, I think every culture certainly at the baseline level differs in the types of sort of hallucinations and notions. So because you have this spirit possession narrative, oftentimes the sense of hearing voices and so forth is very much tied up in religious beliefs, and you're hearing a different thing. So, you know, cultures certainly define, at least on that most superficial level, the content of delusional hearing voices and so forth. Our Western ideas of schizophrenia have reached all the way down to Zanzibar. They have a mental hospital there. They have mental health healers. So oftentimes it's this very interesting thing where you have this spirit possession belief existing side by side with Western ideas. And sometimes you think they would always be in conflict, but sometimes they simply exist side by side. There is this notion of drug treatment and so forth for schizophrenia, and that exists side by side with this notion of spirit possession. So there is no place in the world where the idea of mental illness is not influenced by the Western notions anymore. They exist all over the place.
Ethan, one of the things that talking with you makes me think about is just the way in which the United States, we're a multicultural society, and so you've been talking about the sort of the global implications of your research, but I think that the insights that you have about the marketing, the politics, the cultural context, the way in which we interpret experiences being variable, highly variable, and also the way in which we're not discovering something that's natural, biological, genetic, that's just out there, but we're actually participating in a sense, in constructing it or creating it. I think this has enormous implications for how we understand what gets diagnosed as mental illness in the United States. What do you think are the implications of your work for thinking about mental health issues here in the U.S. and in Western countries?
It is a very interesting question. As you suggest, we have many immigrant cultures to varying degrees isolated or assimilated into our cities and our nation. And then you have, you know, a variety of mental health apparatuses within those cultures. And the difficult thing is, it's very difficult to say anything that could be true across those mixes. So you have, Latin American cultures who have different beliefs about schizophrenia existing in Los Angeles, interacting with a mental, you know, obviously an extremely westernized mental health apparatus. What can be done in that specific situation? And I think that's you know, mostly I was looking across borders because I could see the distinctions more clearly. You have to, you know, when you talk about a specific example, you have to talk about, you know, the level of acculturation that, you know, that one subgroup has within one particular community, and the ways in which that mental health apparatus might be able to utilize that other culture's beliefs to help healing. I guess, so it's very hard to say anything that's true in all those cases because it just becomes incredibly complicated. I guess maybe I would say that I think within those immigrant cultures, as they exist in the United States, I think it's important to at least alert mental health healers that there are narratives and there are beliefs that might be very valuable, and to not simply attempt to apply Western notions in every case, because I think we can assume that to the extent that a culture stays salient for a given population in America, within that culture are beliefs about the mind that may indeed be quite valuable. I thought about, you know, how to bring these ideas home in sort of a way that's not quite parallel to your question, but I think it's an interesting story, which is that, you know, this anthropologist Julie Magruder, who I followed down to Zanzibar, came back to Tacoma, where she was finishing her dissertation on this topic, and her husband, who had been with her down in Zanzibar, had a psychotic break. He had a psychotic manic episode where he was arrested and thrown into a psychiatric ward. And, you know, Julie Magruder was in this interesting position of having just finished studying another culture's ways in which they ameliorate these problems through cultural means. And she tried as best she could to take the lessons that she had learned in Zanzibar about how families, you know, keep this ill individual within the group, and how they use religious notions sometimes to help avoid blame and shame. But interestingly enough, try as she might to take those ideas in Zanzibar and employ them to her benefit, she simply couldn't do it. And I think the lesson in that situation is that it's rather easy to export a drug or the DSM, but it is very difficult to import an idea like the spirit possession notion into our culture, because it is simply sort of layered very deeply into the cultural beliefs, and it simply permeates a household. And it's not something that's very easy to sort of say, oh, well, that's a good thing we could take and use for ourselves. So in a way, I think what other cultures possess is rather difficult to import because it's so layered into their belief system, where our notions about a drug or about a diagnosis can rather easily be exported.
Well, it sounds like in the example of Zanzibar and spirit possession that it's not just a set of beliefs, but it's actually a whole social system. It's a whole social fabric. It's actually part of the very life, everyday life of that society. So it's not just simply interpreting a symptom differently, but the fact that you have, say, an extended family, that you have religious practices and rituals that people can be part of, and you'd have to kind of rebuild the community around the belief as well. I think it's a really interesting discussion, because a lot of us are facing the fact that the mental health system in the U.S. has essentially failed. We're not giving people the kinds of treatments and supports, and we're not getting the outcomes, we're not getting the effectiveness that we want, and it's become a big marketing opportunity, and very, very poor science and very, very risky treatments. And some people are helped, certainly, but overall, we're not making progress. And so I think the points that your book is making really suggest to me that a lot of the things that we've been talking about on Madness Radio, what are the alternatives to the mental health system, that we can look to other cultures and look to these basic principles and basic ideas, but then we have to think about how do we reinvent it here in the West. And I think the idea of the Hearing Voices movement, the idea of focusing on community responses rather than individual responses. I've had Paula Kaplan on the show before, who does a lot of work on veterans and returning vets, and then often it isn't the case that sitting down individually, getting psychotherapy, taking a pill, it often isn't the best way to deal with war trauma, that maybe we need collective social responses, we need group healing and community development. So I think there's a tremendous opportunity to learn from the research that you've done in your wonderful book, Crazy Like Us. So I really encourage people to read this book, and it's an incredibly valuable resource, and the research that you've done is tremendous. And how has the book been received? What's been the response like? Is it selling well? What has been the reaction from both professionals, anthropologists, academics, and the general public?
Well, it sparked a conversation that it's been really enjoyable for me to be involved in. The book is not intended to be didactic. It's not intended to pound a point home it's intended to be a spark of a conversation about these issues and to allow us to think about our own national and subcultural mental health illnesses and how we can individually and as groups take charge of them and who we want to give the power to define these states. So the conversation has been just a joy to be part of. I found it very interesting within the mental health profession that I have not gotten a lot of pushback. In fact, you know, the psychiatrists and professionals that have responded to it have almost unanimously agreed with the fundamental principle of the argument. Interestingly enough, though, they rarely agree about, they rarely see it as a fault of their own. So they'll say things like, you're absolutely right, this is really a problem, but it's really true of the guy down the hall or, you know, the guy in the other institute. When we go into a culture, we really know what we're doing. So it's one of those things that I think is very easy to see about someone else and very difficult to accept that maybe you've made some of the mistakes that I have documented. But I think I'm really enjoying the conversation that it's sparked, and it sparked a lot of interest. So I'd love to hear from readers and people who are thinking about this idea and enjoying the ideas in the book. And they can find me through crazylikeus.com. There's an email there that can get right to me. And I really do hope this conversation continues to go on. The book comes out in paperback this spring, and
Ethan Waters, thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio.
I very much enjoyed the discussion. Thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to an interview with Ethan Waters. Ethan is a San Francisco-based author and freelance journalist who's been writing about psychiatry for over 20 years. His recent book is Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche, published by Free Press.
And thanks to the host, Bill Hall, for that. If you like that show, you can find more in a similar vein from madnessradio.net. I was going to read another Steve Talbot article here, but they're not easy to read, and there actually isn't time, so I'm going to summarize it, which I hope you'll find more accessible than a direct reading. The article's called The Poverty of the Instructed Organism. Are you and your cells programmed? He starts the article by explaining that biologists have had a hard time for the last two centuries trying to explain how life can arise out of these mechanical processes, which has been the main focus of their investigations. DNA and RNA, he says, were leapt upon by the biologists as sort of information carriers, and the metaphor of the computer was absolutely irresistible. Suddenly, living beings became computers. DNA and RNA and genes were the programs that ran the computers. And he quotes Dawkins, "There is no spirit-driven life force. No throbbing, heaving, pollulating, protoplasmic, mystic jelly. Life is just bytes and bytes and bytes of digital information." Then he goes on to look at these bytes of information. This DNA, if we change one nucleotide base, it can have unfathomably complicated ramifications. A single mutated letter, as it happens, may exert its influences and in turn be influenced in remarkably diverse ways. It might, for example, raise or lower the melting temperature of its local strand of DNA, the temperature at which the two strands of DNA of a double helix disengage from each other, thereby making transcription easier or more difficult at that location. Or it might contribute toward a more or less bendable DNA sequence, crucially affecting the DNA's ability to interact with various regulatory proteins, or it might promote local narrowing of one or two of the spiraling grooves running the length of the double helix, again modulating accessibility for certain regulatory factors, or it might alter the electrical characteristics of the DNA, or in various other ways, it might change the local binding potentials of any of the numerous molecules involved in structuring chromatin, the elaborate DNA-RNA protein complex that constitutes our chromosomes and is so central to today's vast literature on gene regulation, and yet again, it might contribute to the formation of those non-canonical DNA structures, alternatives to the straightforward double helix, now gaining increasing attention, structures such as G quadruplexes, Hoogsteen base pairs, and DNA-RNA triplexes, or it might do several of these things at once, and many others still unmentioned. So, if you thought it was as simple as,
The DNA is copied by the RNA, expresses some proteins. That is a tremendously oversimplified picture of what's happened. And if there's one thing all the biologists are agreed on, what is going on is extremely complicated. So, as Talbot says, none of this vast wealth of expressive potential looks a lot like the kind of thing that you can be specified by approximately two yes or no bits of information, supposedly contained in one letter of the DNA sequence. So then he notes there's two kinds of description going on here. There's the description where you look at the matter and say, these are the molecular processes, this is the physical and this is the chemistry going on. Then there's another set of description where you say, this is what the organism is trying to do, this is how the cell wall is being repaired. All the second level description assumes that there is some meaning, that there's some organism or some meaningful structure with its own purposes that it's trying to carry out. So, this initially seems to fit the computer analogy. Computer, you can look at it on a level of bytes of information, which is the meaning carried out by the physical processes, all the electrons whizzling around, which is the low-level description, if you like. So then he talks about seeing computers as organisms. Now, Talbot points out how keen the biologists were to embrace the computer analogy. Quoting François Jacob, who won the Nobel Prize for work on gene expression, everything urges one to compare the logic of heredity to that of a computer. Rarely has a model suggested by a particular epoch proved to be more fruitful. Now he concludes with Dawkins again, another extreme interpretation. Quote, it's raining instructions out there, it's raining programs, it's raining tree-growing, fluff-spreading algorithms. This is not a metaphor, it is the plain truth. It couldn't be any plainer if it were raining floppy disks. So he then goes on to look at what the modern computer is, actually. It's a very high-tech, hierarchical control system. As he says, modern chips are made in factories costing hundreds of millions or billions of dollars, because if there's a single speck of dust in the manufacturing process, the chips don't work. The buses, memory, CPU chips are running hundreds of millions of times per second in lockstep. So, computers are incredibly precise, and they have to be that way. Now, Talbot contrasts this with cells, which are never in the same situation twice, but always have to adapt to some external disturbance from the environment. He notes that whilst evolving embryos are predictable to a greater or lesser extent in the gross, the individual cells are impossible to predict. So it's not like a computer where there's a hierarchical control of what happens. There's a great deal of autonomy on the individual cellular level, and the cells are making decisions and passing those down to other levels. He also makes the point that organisms have bodies while computers don't. Computers are deliberately abstracted logic. Computer software deliberately doesn't care what hardware it's running on. So it's abstracted from the real world, deliberately so. Nothing that's living can be abstracted from the real world or translated into other materials. So his conclusion is that it's a very misleading metaphor. So, for our purposes, why did I think this was a relevant thought? Well, we just heard Ethan Miller on how the man as machine model suits the interests of the drug companies, who approach everybody in all cultures with the same medicine and a list of diseases and symptoms, a checklist that says this is how life is, we will make life this way, and this is a good thing, as opposed to, in our second hour, we're going to hear from a woman who reached some very unusual decisions about what she wanted to do with her life and went on and did them. Well, I regularly see hundreds of people walking in pretty dispirited fashion, usually, to work, where they're going to be sitting together doing tasks that are by design as identical as possible in what is very much a top-down hierarchical control system, something that might even have been designed on the computer. Can you see the connection between the poverty of the instructed human, the sweatshop labourer, and the poverty of the instructed organism that Talbot is talking about? Talbot is not telling anybody this is the meaning of life, but he is suggesting that the concept of meaning, organisms having a meaning, purposes, perhaps you and me having purposes for our lives, which are not externally defined, that might be a valuable, indeed an essential thought to bear in mind while we acknowledge that the physical stuff of our bodies does obey predictable laws. And now we're going to have, in our second hour, a radio adaptation of a video about an American woman who embraced what was personally meaningful for her to a quite a remarkable extent. And if you want to watch this video instead of listen to it, it's available on YouTube or by download from our website, unwelcomeguest.net.